Welcome to The Critique. Today we are looking at Operationalizing Viability, a constraint-based framework for managing complex systems by balancing load, adaptation, reserve, and structure. The theory is robust, but the transition to practical application needs immediate work. So let's jump straight into Part 1.3.
I am definitely ready to dive in. The text sets out to redefine systemic stability entirely, which is an incredibly ambitious goal. And to achieve that, well, the author brings out some extremely heavy theoretical artillery right out of the gate.
The introduction of the E7 Cortic invariant establishes a strong theoretical foundation, but its connection to the four operational proxies requires a far more explicit conceptual linkage.
Yeah, we're talking about that massive conceptual pivot right in the middle of the first chapter. I mean, the author introduces this highly specific, highly complex math concept.
Right.
The E7 invariant, which deals with exceptional Lie groups and 56-dimensional spaces. And they frame it as the absolute mathematical boundary of viable trajectories for any system.
Which is a huge claim. The underlying weakness here is that the text introduces this invariant, explicitly admits that it cannot actually be measured in practice, and then immediately pivots to the four operational proxies.
Load, structure, adaptation, and reserve.
Exactly. Without fully explaining how those four specific tools derive from that mathematical absolute. So it leaves a massive gap in the logic.
It really does. I mean, think about the operational friction there. If I am a systems engineer or an economic policymaker reading this manual, and I am told, here is the ultimate mathematical truth of the universe.
But you cannot measure it.
Right, but you cannot measure it, so just use these four proxies instead. I am immediately going to question a methodology. Why those four?
Exactly. Why not three?
Yeah, or five. Are they mathematically derived from the Cortic invariant, or did the author just select four concepts that sound intuitively useful?
And that disconnect is what makes the foundational premise feel slightly untethered from the practical application. It strands the practitioner. Our suggestion for improvement is to explicitly define the mapping between the mathematical properties of the invariant and the operational components, or simply reevaluate whether naming the specific mathematical invariant is even necessary for the target audience.
But how would that actually look on the page? Are we talking about adding, like, a massive mathematical appendix full of non-associative algebra proofs?
Oh, no.
Because dragging a wastewater plant manager through advanced theoretical physics is going to absolutely destroy the pacing of an operational manual.
An appendix is definitely not necessary. As a concrete example for improvement, one highly effective approach would be to add a brief explanatory paragraph in Part 1.3 detailing exactly why a Cortic invariant conceptually demands exactly four interacting systemic components.
Ah, I see.
You just show the structural lineage. Connect the four mathematical dimensions directly to load, structure, adaptation, and reserve. That way, the reader trusts the origin of the tools they are about to use.
Establish the pedigree, then move on. But, well, let me push back a bit on whether establishing that theoretical pedigree is even helpful here.
Okay, go ahead.
If this is truly a guide for practitioners operating in the field, is including the E7 terminology just alienating them? To me, it feels like handing a driver the thermodynamic equations of an internal combustion engine, when all they really need to know is how to read the dashboard and shift gears.
That is a great analogy.
Right? Because does the thermodynamic equation actually help you steer out of a skid?
It absolutely does not help you in the skid. So an alternative, practical suggestion, if the mathematical rigor is not the primary focus for the practitioner, is that the E7 invariant could be framed purely as an abstract metaphor tucked away in a footnote.
Just get it out of the main text.
Exactly. By relocating the heavy theoretical terminology out of the main flow, the text stays entirely focused on the relational dynamics of the four observable components. You give them the dashboard, not the engine schematics.
I strongly prefer that second option, honestly. It respects the underlying science without bogging down the operational focus.
Right.
Because if I am managing a crisis, I do not care about the dimensions of a Lie group. I care about how much systemic reserve I have left before the whole system breaks.
The cross-domain applications successfully prove the framework's universality, but they lack the distinct, measurable grounding that makes the earlier clinical case studies so compelling.
You are referring to the acute decompensated heart failure case study in Part 5.
Yes.
That section is just a masterpiece of operational tension.
It truly is. The way the author demonstrates the concept of the structural shadow in that medical scenario is incredibly visceral. The text paints a picture of a patient in the ICU. Their blood pressure appears perfectly stable. The surface structure is holding.
But underneath, it's a disaster.
Exactly. The lactate levels are rising rapidly, and urine output is dropping.
You can practically feel the underlying reserve being drained by the immense adaptive effort required to keep that blood pressure looking normal.
Yeah.
The structural shadow isn't just an abstract idea in that chapter. It is a measurable, localized, undeniable conflict between specific physical proxies.
And that brings us to the weakness in Part 6. While the clinical study brilliantly illustrates the structural shadow using exact metrics, the examples for engineering, economics, and governance remain highly generalized.
Just too broad.
Way too broad. Describing economic load merely as debt, or governance load as social pressure. It lacks the quantifiable, warring tension of the medical example. It makes it significantly harder for practitioners in those specific fields to visualize the exact moment the shadow forms on their own dashboards.
Reading the medical drama is thrilling because of that specificity, whereas the governance section, well, it reads a bit more like a theoretical summary. But let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure.
Socioeconomic systems are notoriously fuzzy and distributed. I mean, can you even put a blood pressure cuff on a macroeconomy or a society? Biological systems have precise, evolved boundaries, whereas human systems do not.
They do not have biological boundaries, no, but they absolutely generate specific, conflicting data streams. And our suggestion is that the text must ground these broad cross-domain generalizations with specific, localized proxy conflicts that mirror the precision of the heart failure case.
So show the exact clash of metrics.
Yes, because the underlying mechanism is identical across all domains. Adaptive effort is burning reserve to maintain a structural illusion. We just need to give the reader the exact metrics to watch.
So we need to give the governance expert their equivalent of blood pressure versus lactate. How do we build that out so it doesn't just sound like a random list of economic indicators?
Concrete examples for improvement would involve specifying exactly which metrics diverge when the structural shadow forms in each domain.
Okay, let's look at the wastewater engineering example first.
Right. Instead of just saying the plant faces load, the text could specify that effluent turbidity, which is how clear the water looks leaving the plant, remains perfectly steady.
So that is our surface structure. That is the blood pressure.
Exactly. But simultaneously, biological oxygen demand and aeration energy costs are quietly skyrocketing.
That is a perfect parallel. The turbidity holds the illusion of stability, while the aeration costs reveal the hidden strain. You're showing the exact moment the metrics decouple from reality.
Yeah.
What about the macroeconomic example then? Because just saying a country has debt doesn't capture the tension at all.
For the economic system, the text could explicitly describe a scenario where top-line employment stays flat, giving the illusion of health, while central bank liquidity injections increase exponentially.
Oh, I see. So the practitioner can immediately see that employment is only holding steady because the massive adaptive effort is completely masking the rapid depletion of the system's underlying monetary reserve.
Exactly. That makes the structural shadow visible in real time for an economist.
And for governance, because you cannot just say trust erodes. Trust is a feeling, you know, it's not a dashboard metric.
Right. Instead of abstract trust, the text could specify that citation rates or arrest quotas remain perfectly consistent. So the enforcement structure is seemingly intact.
But then what is the hidden cost?
While the citations look good, internal whistleblower reports and civilian complaints double over the exact same period.
Wow. Yeah.
It forces the reader to confront the reality that an observable, stable surface metric is never sufficient evidence of system health.
That expands the framework. It explains how the theory scales, rather than just asserting that it scales.
Right.
It proves that the balancing of these four forces happens everywhere, whether it is a failing human heart, a struggling water treatment plant, or a collapsing municipal government.
Which brings us to the most critical, high-stakes decision a practitioner has to make in any of those scenarios.
Knowing exactly when to stop controlling the system and start navigating it.
The definition of the temporal boundary provides a vital conceptual pivot from acute stabilization to constraint-based navigation, but its reliance on subjective lagging indicators
risks delaying the critical transition.
We are talking about the transition from phase 1 to phase 2, which is detailed in part 2.3.
Yes.
Phase 1 is acute stabilization. It is pure survival mode. You force the variables to hold at all costs.
Right. And this is where the text introduces the incredible danger of non-associativity. In mathematics, changing the grouping of operations changes the fundamental result.
And in systems engineering, doing the right thing at the wrong time is incredibly destructive.
Applying a tourniquet for 10 minutes saves a life. Keeping it clamped for 10 hours costs the patient their leg.
The author actually calls this coherence debt. The intervention that preserves a system in the short term actively destroys its ability to persist in the long term. It is a terrifying paradox to manage.
It really is. And the crucial weakness in part 2.3 is defining the temporal boundary, the exact moment you need to remove the tourniquet, by retrospective conditions.
Wait, how does the text currently define it?
The text advises the operator to wait until the system is no longer in immediate danger and begins to show some responsiveness to change.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because these are qualitative and lagging observations, a practitioner operating under the intense pressure of acute collapse might miss these subtle cues and inadvertently plunge the system directly into the load trap.
I have a serious problem with the phrase "no longer in immediate danger."
It's very subjective.
Extremely. If you are managing a collapsing electrical grid or a failing central bank, the psychological fog of war is absolute.
Exactly.
Everything looks and feels like immediate danger. If you tell an operator to let go of the controls only when they feel it is safe to do so, they will never let go. The terror of the collapse they just witnessed will keep their hands glued to the steering wheel.
Waiting to observe a lagging indicator, like some responsiveness, guarantees the damage is already done.
Right.
Our suggestion is that the text must augment the definition of the temporal boundary with a protocol for identifying leading indicators or threshold limits that signal the boundary is approaching, rather than relying solely on the realization that it has already been crossed.
So we have to pull the practitioner out of their own subjective terror and anchor them to objective, forward-looking tripwires.
Exactly.
But how is that mathematically or operationally possible? If the surface variables are artificially locked down by phase one stabilization interventions, you literally cannot measure the system's actual trajectory.
Well, if you cannot measure the output, you have to measure the input. A concrete example for improvement would be introducing a rate of change metric to the viability navigation protocol to track diminishing returns on external effort.
Okay, walk me through that.
For instance, stipulating that when the amount of external effort required to maintain a given variable begins to plateau or require exponential increases just to hold the line, the temporal boundary is imminent.
Let me process how that works mechanically. You track the acceleration of the intervention itself.
Yes.
So if yesterday it took $10 million of liquidity to hold the market steady, and today it takes $50 million of liquidity to hold the exact same line, your rate of return is collapsing.
Exactly.
The effort is entirely decoupling from your result. That is your leading indicator that phase one stabilization is becoming toxic, even if the market looks perfectly stable on the surface.
Right. But even tracking the rate of change requires a level of real-time analysis that might be impossible in a rapidly unfolding crisis.
Because people are panicking.
Yes. So another highly effective concrete suggestion is that operators set a predefined time limit or resource constraint rule at the very initiation of phase one. This would act as an automatic trigger to pause and reevaluate for phase two navigation.
Wait, so before they even apply the intervention, they define the exact moment they will stop?
Yes.
Isn't that dangerous? I mean, what if the system hasn't fully stabilized yet? What if they pull the plug too early?
That is exactly why it is necessary. It acts as an automatic forced circuit breaker.
Okay, I see.
If a central bank declares, "We will apply aggressive liquidity injections for exactly 72 hours, and at hour 73, we mandate a systemic review regardless of market conditions."
You completely remove the subjective bias of the fog of war.
Exactly. You force the practitioner to actively justify continuing the tourniquet, rather than passively defaulting to it out of fear.
That completely rewires the decision architecture. Because as the text points out so beautifully, beyond a critical point, trying harder actually makes the system less stable.
Right.
A forced circuit breaker is a structural tool to stop the practitioner from trying harder,
precisely when trying harder is the very thing destroying the system.
It removes the human flaw from the equation entirely.
Yeah.
To bring all of this together, this critique focused entirely on maximizing the operational impact of the viability framework.
It really is about making it usable.
We explored clarifying the conceptual linkage between the theoretical E7 invariant and the four operational proxies. We discussed grounding the cross-domain examples with highly specific divergent metrics akin to the clinical case study. And we looked at establishing leading indicators to proactively identify the temporal boundary before the system enters the load trap.
So the actionable next steps for the author are to review part 1.3 to either explicitly map or metaphorically streamline the mathematical invariants.
Yes.
Then inject specific diverging proxy metrics into the engineering, economic, and governance examples in part 6.
Right.
And finally, add a mechanism like an effort-based rate of change or a forced circuit breaker for anticipating the temporal boundary in part 2.
This material is incredibly robust and deeply thought-provoking. It challenges the fundamental ways we view stability and how we intervene in the world. We highly encourage the author to submit the revised work back to us for another critique in the future.
It truly reminds us that when we hit that patch of black ice, aggressively wrestling with the steering wheel doesn't actually save us.
No, it doesn't.
It just creates the illusion of control while momentum decides our fate. The only way through is to understand the actual constraints of the machine, ease off the controls, and navigate the true trajectory.
Well said. Until next time.